This is an MUT Radio podcast.
Hello, I'm Dr. Amalia Gonyas-Malka. Welcome to Womanity, Woman in Unity, the show that celebrates women's milestone achievements in their struggle for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, democracy, and much more. Today, we're talking with Dr. Tia Schulman, who is Head of Department in Geography, Environmental, Management, and Energy Studies in the Faculty of Science at the University of Johannesburg. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me to participate. I'm looking forward to this interaction.
Dr. Schulman, you have built an incredibly distinguished academic career with a focus on environmental management and specifically looking at waste minimization. Can you tell us what first sparked your interest in this field and also how your journey has led you on to specialize in the informal waste sector?
So I can remember getting my first degree in 1990, sitting there listening to somebody else getting a doctorate on the word, the use of one word in three different languages that's not spoken in South Africa. And I thought, what? And I promised myself as a 21-year-old, if I ever were to conduct research, it must have some societal impact and some advantage to the environment. So, you know, this is embodied in sustainable development goals nowadays. So I would like to think I'm a bit in front of the curve. So my master's was actually in ecotourism because I was based in a province in South Africa called the Free State. So this was in the 1990s. I did research on ecotourism and then I moved over to Johannesburg. And although I studied in Joburg in the 1980s, when I came back in the late 1990s, there was a huge increase in illegal dumping, littering and everything. So waste, because it was noticeable, was for me a very obvious environmental problem. When I started reading up on that, there was almost no research conducted in that field. And to be honest, when I moved into the field in the early 2000s, it was really, really difficult. People didn't want to share with me. Government departments didn't want to talk to me. I even had one government official say to me, "Are you crazy? What is a woman wanting to do with waste? It's dirty and women should not be involved in this kind of research." And I thought, what? So I've never had a recycling program in my area, and I've always had waste reclaimers, the waste pickers. And I've been recycling since 1998 when I moved here, making use of the informal sector. So I started looking at the informal sector. I've done research on them, their problems. The most recent research I did was on perceived health implications for landfill waste pickers. It's very difficult to research health on waste pickers because we never have a baseline. So, but we can ask them their perceptions about their health. So, and although people don't think so, waste is really a serious, serious environmental problem. In climate change, waste is number three in terms of the release of methane, and which in methane is a really serious greenhouse gas emission. So anything nowadays, it's got to do with the circular economy. It's got to do with scarce minerals and metals that we need to recover from waste. And I think it's really an area where, because there's so little knowledge and waste data is a big problem, that I can make a serious contribution in South Africa.
Fascinating. And what I love about these conversations is that it really makes me look at things a little bit more closely and pay more attention to, let's say, services that are happening in your environment that you don't fully appreciate.
Yeah.
And when you're talking about the waste pickers and also the fact that waste accounts for number three in terms of climate change with the emission of methane in particular, what happens when the waste pickers have, or let's say reclaimers, have picked the waste from households? Where do they go? What happens to that waste?
Yeah, so My research showed that the majority of them sell their waste to scrap metal dealers. So these scrap metal dealers take metals, they take paper, they take because of spatial based locations, if you to put it like. They also sell their waste to buyback centers, and some of them also sell their waste to e-waste recyclers. But a majority of them, because we call them actually the ones in the street, we call them trolley pushers, although they and really it's a very heavy load that they have to, they actually have to travel quite far if they have to go to a buyback center. And then what they do, they're quite individualistic. They don't work so easily together, but if needed, they do work together, especially when they've collected heavy materials like metals. They will get together and hire somebody. In South Africa, we call a truck a bakkie, and they will get somebody with the truck to come and collect, and they will sell their metals to this person then. So it's a real, the informal sector is organizing themselves. They know where to go, what to do, where to sell. Some of their needs in my research, they don't have much needs. They want some personal protection equipment. They want place to sort their waste, to store their waste, and more fair pricing. As they said to me the one day, they pay, say, get paid 50 cents for a kilogram of white paper, and the next day it's 2 rand 50. So they wanted some government protection, you know, from the middleman. So, and they are marginalized by government. This is my personal opinion. We've got guidelines how to integrate them into our waste management services. A colleague of mine, Professor Melanie Sampson, did the guidelines and everything, and it's just ignored. They're not part of the formal waste structure in South Africa, but they're the true recyclers in South Africa. They're the people that recycle. South Africans do not recycle. Yes, there are some, but a majority don't. And research by the CSIR showed that they save South African municipalities about 750 million rand a year on landfill airspace. So we really just need to make it easier for them so that they can do recycling better and increase their livelihoods. Because they really sometimes are paid, you know, some of them only earn something like 300 rand a week, which is really, really very little money. So, yeah, I'm very proud of the informal sector. And I always say when I'm at a conference, because they are really the true recyclers in South Africa. I've got a PhD in recycling, and I sometimes don't know if a product is recyclable or not, but I just have to go to my local waste picker and say, Daniel, is this a recyclable or not? He's the expert, so he advises me on what is recyclable and what's not.
Thank you for sharing those fascinating insights. And I honestly think that there is a lack of education countrywide in terms of recycling and where you go, which is why people, households have this dependency on reclaimers. Now, moving ahead, you'd mentioned that when you were engaging in this field and starting out, that sometimes there was a bit of resistance. Why is a woman doing this? Why are you interested in this topic, etc. So, as someone who works in science and academia, can you tell us a few defining moments that have helped shaped your confidence as well as your leadership identity?
So one of the things is I consider myself as a problem solver. I'm really very good. Give me a problem and I will solve it. I'm not always so good on the emotional side of things, but you know, each of us has our own strength. And what happened quite a couple of years ago, staff and the faculty of science at then the Randse Afrikaanse University, because we merged, realized that there's this youngish woman that's a problem solver, and they started pulling me into projects, and they recognized my contribution, because I think often if you're good in something and you're not recognized, you give up. You know, recognition in the workplace very, very seldom occurs, you know. So that's something that I also try as the HOD to give recognition where people really makes, because You worked very hard, and then nobody noticed it. So I was noticed, and I was given the opportunity to lead projects and do. We, for example, had a huge program review that was done after the merger and so on. And it builds up your confidence if somebody say you did a good job and thank you. So that was when it came to my research, conducted in research. Interesting enough, in South Africa, a lot of the researchers are women. For example, Professor Linda Godfrey and Suzanne Olufse from the CSIRO, Prof. Rini Schenk from the University of the Western Cape, Prof. Claudine Roos from the Northwest University, and even in professional bodies like the International Solid Waste Association, there's women of waste, a sector in that. So if you also go, we have quarterly meetings in Gauteng, the Waste Management Forum. If you go there, a lot of them are women and they're running their own businesses. So, seeing other women achieving success in the field, and we are supporting each other, we share information, we co-supervise. That really helps as well because then you don't feel so alone. Because sometimes it can be very lonely in academia if you specialize in a certain field. But if there's a couple of you, and it's not like male colleagues are not making contributions, but it really helps building up confidence. Especially older, more experienced researchers can mentor you and say, this is better to do than this and so on. So yeah, there were a couple of moments, but it was a, I would say a gradual build up, over the years until where I am today.
And do you find the field to be, let's say, gender friendly towards women, given that you've said that there are a lot of researchers who are women and focusing on this niche area?
Not when I started, definitely not. Especially if you interacted with government, it was a male-dominated environment. I quoted what one government official said to me earlier in this interview, but it totally changed over the years. And I think it's just because so many women went into waste and waste management and recycling. One of the leaders in one of the waste picker organization, she was, she's a woman and so on. So yeah, so no gender, that thing about genders and women should be not be in waste, something of the past, luckily.
Good to hear. Now, your department has got a very broad name: geography, environmental management, and energy studies. So, as head of this space, can you share aspects of your leadership philosophy and how you foster an inclusive and empowering environment, both for staff as well as students?
So, we are really very, very broad. As a geographer, people always think, oh, the capitals of the world, which is very frustrating. I know much more. We are the people that can put everything together. We're quite popular nowadays to employ. And so we have colleagues that specialize in serious 4R applications and machine learning and so on. We've got colleagues that does research on human vulnerability. So it's really a very, very broad field. So depending on the individual, if it's a young researcher, there's mentorship always comes in. But if I have to choose one type of leadership, I will say it's transformational. I try to inspire and motivate staff to do their best because I didn't get that in my early academic career. I was told, this is what you do, this is what you teach. I, for example, at one stage taught five courses in one term. I barely slept. So I'm trying to be a very fair and transparent leader as well. As I say to my colleagues, I'm the poor soul that has to do all the admin so that you can do your job. And that's fine because I'm, old academic, I'm more established. So it gives the younger people in the department to build up a research and a teaching portfolio and so on. When it comes to our students and our staff, we are very lucky. We as staff get together like a house on fire, literally. There is no issues. I've got extremely competent staff. I don't have to tell them what to do or how to do their jobs. They know how to do it. New staff members are, of course, mentored and so on. But our students often comes with a huge amount of problems to the university, whether it's financial, mental, social, accommodation issues. And I'm very, very proud of the University of Johannesburg because I think we were one of the first universities that realized our students are in trouble, a big part of our students. So we've got feeding schemes, we've got so much support, writing schools, psychological services, social services, and so on. So in the department, we've got tutors, demis, and mentors. And those are more senior students, and they interact a lot with our students. So we're quite transparent. We want to have a safe environment, inclusive environment in our department so that students can feel safe to come and talk to us if they have problems. And it happens quite a lot. And we can refer them to the correct service or support division in UJ. If they're not comfortable speaking to us, they can speak to our mentors or tutors and demis. They can help them and so on. So we really try to catch all the students that feel let out. What's bad for our students when they arrive at university? They're often from rural areas. They're scared of that death, the evil Joburg. They don't have friends. So, for example, I teach first years the whole year, and we then make them do group work so that at least they have some friends that can help them and support them, that they don't feel so alone. And that's quite successful. So I'm conducting research on that because I also publish in the Science of Teaching and Learning. So hopefully, in 3 years' time, I will have more information to share with fellow colleagues, if the what I call it project-based learning. So yeah, it's not easy always. You cannot always catch everyone, but we try. This is the best we can do. We can try. And I think our students have very good relationships with staff. If I listen to it, if I listen to the students, if I read the feedback they give us, we are very lucky in that regard. So yeah.
So much to think about that it's not just delivering a course, a qualification, a degree, but all of this support infrastructure that is so vital to, let's say, produce a creative, confident, productive human being, and acknowledge where people come from and what their constraints are. So fantastic that you've got all of these support services in place. Props comment, we are a gender-based show, and STEM is obviously one of the core fields of growth: science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And obviously, that taps into the environmental discipline. Thinking about the practical aspects, what types of opportunities do you see emerging for women in green jobs, circular economies, and sustainability-focused careers?
Huge, really huge. If you go and read up, green jobs are the job sector that shows the biggest growth. We have some school outreach programs. For example, some of our postgraduate students do a Habitable Planet program with students in Eldorado Park, which is a township in the Joburg area. We must also be realistic. Not everyone can do the science and the maths. I'm also a qualified maths teacher because my majors are geography and maths, so I'm well aware. But there's also social science. There's social impact assessments that students can do. So we reach out to these schools and girls to say to them, a scientist is not only one that's in a lab coat, in a science lab. There's so much more opportunities. So we really produce a lot of female students that go and have great careers in the green jobs. And to get these young girls to get away from these gender stereotypes, that That is very difficult. We have limited influence in schools. We have limited influence in households and so on. But we try to spread a message as far as we can. We've got school interactions, and it's very nice when they come to our department because all three, both myself and my two deputies, we are women. So that's often commented on when female learners come and say, oh, it's a woman leadership. And I say to them, yes, this is where you can be. You just need to work hard, decide what you want to do. If the physical science is not for you, there's also the social sciences. So there's so many job opportunities. On my LinkedIn profile, if I log on, I repost on average, I calculated about seven jobs. I log on about, I think, 2 to 3 times a week, and it's in climate change, it's in sustainability. And because the environmental problems are so complex, there's a space for everyone. If you like humans, there's space for human research. If you like really zoology, there's space for that. So the field is so big and is growing so fast, and it's so needed. I don't want to depress people always with my knowledge about the environment, but we really need to take action. Let me stop there and say, and the green job sector growing so fast is a good thing to see because they promote sustainability. And what's also nice, it's also trying to get really up until the community level, how it's affecting the community. We're doing a lot of research in our department on indigenous knowledge as well. So, how to cope with these climate changes and so on. So, yeah, I think the field is wide open. And if you go and look at how many women are successful in this field, you can always refer to these women as role models for the young women entering a degree or going to school and having to make subject choices.
That role model piece is so important. I've had numerous conversations with people, and where it's been this view of seeing a woman in this position, it somehow just bridges this gap of knowing that it's possible. So I think it's fantastic that you've got this cohort of female leaders to inspire young people to believe and understand that these opportunities are real and it is possible for me. Part of today's conversation involves climate change, and the reality is it affects the entire world. UN Sustainable Development Goal 13 focus specifically on climate change, and they state that global warming is caused by human activities, primarily the burning of fossil fuels like oil, coal, and gas, and threatens life on Earth as we know it. So very, very doom and gloom. But those implications are real. Greenhouse gas emissions are rising. It's causing extreme weather events from droughts, floods, storms, rising sea levels. From your point of view, what would you say are some of the most pressing environmental challenges that face South Africa today?
I think lack of knowledge. People are, if you talk about a global climate change, for the older generation, we talked about global warming, and then they see the snowstorms all over, luckily not in South Africa, but in Europe and so on. And because I'm a geographer, I've got confronted, oh, where's the global warming? And then you try to change, say to them, global climate change. I think some government bodies are doing really, really w good work. I was involved with the Department of Forestry, Fisheries and the Environment last year in a Youth Climate Action Day and so on. And we just need to spread, and first of all, the awareness of climate change, what it means. And then secondly, how can we each make a small contribution? So for us in South Africa, we're a semi-arid country. So half of South Africa is dry, And, I can talk about desertification and how much desertification expanded in South Africa and so on. And it's usually the most vulnerable and poorest communities that will be affected most by climate change. So I think from a social point, that's our biggest problem. From an environmental management point, we is renewable energy, because we are, depending on what source you read, number 12 or number 13 in the world in releasing of carbon dioxide because of our coal-fired power stations. So we're not doing so very well. And because of the electricity crisis we have, there's maybe given some leeway in reducing these greenhouse gas emissions. So renewable energy, and the government is trying, and we're getting there, to go more in our electricity, our power mix, to renewables. So that will be the single most successful thing we can do in terms of climate change, because there are different models. There are three models for South Africa. We can never predict really what's going to happen, but doesn't matter what one happens, it's not going to be good. It's not going to be good for humans, for the environment, and especially, as I said, the vulnerable communities.
You spoke about diversifying the mix of energy, and especially with an emphasis on moving away from coal burning and emissions more towards renewables. For the average person, what can they do to?
I always say to people, you think you have to do something big, something huge. You start small. You start off switching off the lights if you leave a room until it becomes a habit. Then you move over to the next one. For example, separating your waste. Get into the habit, and then you move over to the next one. You do it in a step-like process. And it's not only in terms of climate change, it's like closing the tap while you're brushing your teeth. It is that small behavior changes that are reachable that's going to make a difference. Because it's not one person, but imagine 64 million people change their behavior. Then the impact is going to be huge. So you don't have to go and all of a sudden install a whole solar system at your house, because a lot of people cannot afford it. But it's the small things you need to do and build up. Some of my research showed that people say they're green, but when it comes to be their behavior, they're not green. Especially if it comes like personal comfort, like, sharing a motor vehicle ride, not doing the single, because that's one of the things in South Africa. We don't have a good public transport system. So it's not the big things. Start with the small things and build it up. And then you will make a difference. And all of these small things are reachable. And if you don't know what to do, I always say to people, Google is your friend. Go and read up on the internet and other sources. How can I make a change to protect the environment, to try and reverse climate change or reduce the impact of climate change? And it's not the big things. The small things also contribute.
One of the conversations we've been having is the way things can be framed in different contexts. So, thinking about what you're saying, yes, it's about preserving resources and saving the climate and Earth as a whole. But sometimes that might just feel a little too big for people to contemplate. And I often wonder that if you think about things from a cost point of view, that might also be another dynamic that you're saving on your money, instead of opening the tap and pouring this resource down the drain, save your pennies. Just an idea.
And especially, the cost of power has increased tremendously all over the world. I don't think, and no, currently with the Iran war going on, fuel prices, changing habits is really, really very important if we want to make a difference. I think, there's theories, there's psychological theories like the theory of planned behavior, and we talk about subjective norms and social norms and moral norms and so on. And well, as I said, just try one thing at a time and build it up and try to
So
influence,
practical.
Especially I say to my young students, all the people are fixing their ways, But nothing hinders you to have this conversation with your mom and dad, like switching off the light. So maybe you can tell your parents something to do to have a positive impact on the environment.
And like you said, they're simple things. Just changing one habit at a time adds up. Praskal, we're coming towards the end part of the show, and I'd like to ask more from a personal perspective on a few elements. So, firstly, you have highlighted an incredibly demanding role that spans your leadership, research, significant community engagement. How do you define work-life balance for yourself, and has that definition evolved over time?
And to be honest, I don't. I don't have a work life balance. I'm one of those. I'm a born educator. I can't tell you how much I love teaching. And as my husband showed said to me the other night, you got out of bed 11:30 at night to go back to your computer to help a student that asked a question on a WhatsApp group. And I don't mind it. But don't ask me an early morning question. I'm a night person. I'm too available. But I've made my peace with who and what I am. I'm really because I really would like to support my students. The one thing where I try to do is to sleep late on Saturdays. That's making up. That's me time, But I don't have a work-life balance, to be honest. And I'm very lucky that I've got a very supportive family. They know who and what I am. I do go on family holidays and so on. And they know mommy's going to still answer emails maybe at night and so on. And because it's been the way like that always in my family, there's no problems. There's actually a support because both my sons are young men at the same university where I work and study, and they see how busy I am, how much students need input, how much students need feedback from a lecturer. So I'm very happy and lucky to we have a supportive family. But I can't give any woman advice on a work-life balance, unfortunately.
Don't you think that that's okay? That that's your definition. That's your DNA. It works
Yep.
for you.
I'm totally happy with that. I've always been like this. And so my two boys were born into this, so that I don't think they know anything other than this. I'm happy with that. I don't feel guilty about it. My family gets attention. But I'm also not a person that just can sit in front of a TV and watch a show. I'm always doing something else, So I'm happy where I'm at and so on, but don't ask me advice on work-life balance.
Always on. One question that I ask all my guests on the show is about some of their factors for success. So, in your view, what would you say have been some of the elements that have contributed to your success?
I think the single most thing is that I love my job. I've always been crazy about geography and mathematics, even, from grade four onwards when we started doing it. So if I can give people advice, you spend at least 8 hours a day at your work. Go and read up. Make sure that this is what you would like to do. A lot of people make choices for money. I was offered to become an actuary in my third year as a university student. And as much as I love numbers, I just realized I have to have humans interaction much more than I would. So make sure that what you want to do is something that you would love. Because if you enjoy your job, you will make a success of it. And if you're in a position where you're not quite where you want to do, and where you want to go, do a bit of research. There are so many they call it mass open online courses. There are short courses. So, for example, you in environmental consultancy and you want to go in environmental auditing, there are short courses and stuff that you can do to give you the necessary knowledge to change a career direction. So, for somebody, the single thing I would say to people, make sure you do something that you enjoy, because otherwise your life is going to be really, really miserable. And it's very difficult to make a success of something that you do not like. I'm not very good with languages. If I should be a language educator, oh, I would hate every single moment of that. So I do something that I love, and I'm successful because of, I think, that love of my job.
And can you share a few pivotal moments in your life growing up that had an impact on you?
I'm going to take you back to grade four. One of the teacher's son is what we would call a slow learner. And he was put next to me for the whole of my primary school career. And I was told, Tia, you make sure Hans passes mathematics. And I've taught so many, and I was too good at it. So I ended up in high school also helping a lot of friends with mathematics and science and geography, and I absolutely love it. So from an early age, I knew what I wanted to do. So you don't realize it when you're there, but looking back, somebody asked me, why did you become an educator? Another thing is, when I started doing research on the informal sector, it was an eye-opener for me. It was an eye-opener for me to see their problems, to see how much little needs they do have and how they are treated by, local municipalities and so on. And I would say that was also a pivotal moment, and I got much more involved. I almost started looking at them as a side, thing, because they're part of the waste value chain, and it totally changed the direction of my research, where I literally went in. And then, of course, getting a job at university and seeing it's mo the one of the most rewarding jobs is to see a student walking in with really skills lack because the education system in South Africa does have problems, and they walk out with a master's or a doctorate degree, and then you think, I've done something right. So yeah, those are defining moments in my life.
Very rewarding. And lastly, as we close out today's conversation, can you share a few words of inspiration, motivation that you'd like to pass on to girls and women in the continent who are listening to us?
Don't doubt yourself. If you really put your heart into something that you like, you will make it a success. There's always people that's going to try to say to you, don't do that, or you can't do it. Listen to your heart. You are good. You can do it. And if you don't know how to do something, don't be afraid to ask somebody to help you. Sometimes people are too afraid to ask for help. We can never do everything. So girls, there's so many job opportunities in these fields. Whether you like pure sciences, whether you like social sciences, we've got a space for you. Hang in there, girl. Do your best. You will be successful.
Fantastic message. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's been wonderful hearing about the work you do, the opportunities in the field, and the impact that it has on society locally and around the world.
And thank you for the invite. I'm very privileged to participate in the show.
You have been listening to Womanity, Woman in Unity, and we've been talking to Dr. Tia Schoeman, who is Head of Department in Geography, Environmental Management, and Energy Studies at the Faculty of Science at the University of Johannesburg.
This is an MUT Radio podcast.